Okay, we have come in our study of 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 down to the last statement in that paragraph that goes from what, 5 through 10? Last time when we were looking at verse 9, we saw that there is this extremely sobering fact that there is going to be a whole host of created personalities who, because they do not want to know God and they do not want to submit to the promise of the gospel, and submitting to the promise of the gospel may not be a good way of saying that, but the idea of faith in the promise of the gospel is that you know it's true and then you submit yourself to the truthfulness of it. Because I really do believe that biblical faith is not so much about whether a thing is true. It's the Holy Spirit's job to make us aware that it's true. The issue is, when we see it as true, then this reaction sets in and we say, well, if I commit myself to the truthfulness of that, then this will change and this will change and this will change and this, and I don't want any of that to change, so no, I'm not going to buy into that. So it's not really a truth issue. It's a submission issue, and it has to do, in this text it said obey, but the idea is to hear it and put yourself under it. And people who don't want promise and they don't want to know God are going to be eternally subjected to the issue of eternal degrading of the quality of experience never ends. And it's because of the fact that the Lord has turned his face away from them, so there's no blessing involved. And there is no exercise of his power for their good. That's the idea of being separated from the glory of his power. So that's kind of what we looked at last time, and it is. It's extremely sobering. Jesus said on one occasion that there would be more people who go through the broad gate that leads to destruction than there would be the people who find the narrow gate and enter into life. And the implication of that is that there's an enormous difference in numbers. So the whole issue of the promise of the gospel and buying into the reality of what Jesus has actually come to do is a critical truth issue, and there are real consequences to it. So, this evening what we're going to do is look at the final concept that is addressed in verse 10 with the when, in relation to when he, that is the Lord, comes to be glorified in the saints on that day, and to be marveled at among all those who believed, for our testimony to you was believed. The question of meaning in verse 10 has to do with the issues that are involved in being glorified in his saints and then marveled at among all those who believe. The phraseology is interesting because the word translated in his saints is, the word in is en. On that day, the word on is en. And then to be marveled at among, the word among is en. So Paul uses the same exact preposition three times in this one verse, and it's interesting how much the translators struggle with that, because I did too all week long. I was wondering, what in the world is he driving at here? So our study this evening is going to be on this issue of the in that day. We're going to talk about what that means, the day. And then we're going to talk about what he means by saints and those who believe, because he almost sounds like there's two categories there. Glorified in the saints and marveled at in all those who believe, or by or among or whatever. So, let's just start with the easy thing. That's the day. He's coming in that day. These things are going to happen in that day. And the Of course, the question of in that day is a big issue, simply because in our generation there's been an enormous amount of conflict and argument about whether creation was a 6-24-hour day event, and all of this talk about the word day means day, it means 24 hours, and so on, so on, so on, so on. So when we read in that day, we're kind of intimidated into thinking, well, maybe this is a single day, 24 hours, or whatever. But, and here's where the complications come in. First of all, when he comes in that day, it's not an identifiable thing in respect to our current calendar and setting in history. In other words, his coming is still a mystery. We still don't know when he's coming. The issue of what aspect of his coming is involved here is not hard, because he says they will experience the penalty of eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord when he comes in that day. So obviously this is the day when, or the frame of reference when he is going to reject them. They're going to be subjected to this destructive, this degenerating experience of destruction without age limits. I mean, it's going to start and it's never going to end. So we can't really talk about a particular day. We don't know when that is. We just know that when it is, it's going to happen. And then the thing is that the day that he's talking about is the day of the coming of the Lord. And when he comes in that day, the whole idea of the entire paragraph is that it's a day of wrath. And back in 1 Thessalonians 1:10, the Thessalonians were looking for the coming of the Son from heaven, who delivers us from the wrath that is coming. So the day is a day of wrath. It's a day of retribution. It's a day of payback. But as such, it's not a 24-hour day. The fact is, the word day is used as an extended period of untold number of days, and it's used as a single 24-hour period. And there are both involved in this statement. The phrase, the day of the Lord, which is going to come up in verse 2 of chapter 2 when he talks about don't be disturbed to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. He says don't get all upset if somebody tells you that the day of the Lord has already come, because it hadn't. But the point is, he uses the day of the Lord terminology. And the day of the Lord terminology in both Old and New Testaments includes an extended period of time in which there is one overriding umbrella concept. And that one overriding umbrella concept for this context is the retribution, because he started back there in verse 5 talking about the plain indication of God's legitimate decision, because in verse 6 it's legitimate for God to repay affliction to those who afflict you, when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, dealing out retribution to those who don't know God. And so the whole paragraph, with the exception of the parenthesis in verse 7, to give relief to you who are afflicted and to us as well, except for that parenthetical expression, this whole paragraph is about dealing out retribution. This is the wrath that is coming. This is what Jesus is going to be saving us from by coming. When the Son comes from heaven, he is going to be delivering us from the wrath that's coming. So, obviously, he's going to deliver us before the wrath starts being poured out, and that's part of chapter 2, and we won't get into that tonight. But the point that I want to make is that the phrase, the day of the Lord, in the Old Testament and in the New Testament is a phrase that refers to the day of the Lord in reference to both extreme judgment and significant blessing. So the umbrella in this particular context, the umbrella thesis is retribution. It's the disaster that's going to come. Now, in the Old Testament, the day of the Lord was an extended period of time that was identified in terms of the wrath aspect of it in several ways. For example, it's called the time of Jacob's trouble. Daniel called it the beginning of the 70th week, or the 70th week itself. After 69 weeks, it would be 1 week, and the 1 week is drawn out in Daniel with all kinds of things drawn out, but they're all bad things. And then it's called the day of wrath and retribution. And, of course, from the perspective of those of us who believe that the book of Revelation from chapter 4 through the rest of the book is all about the future, the 70th week of Daniel, the time of Jacob's trouble, from chapters 4 through 19, there are a host of disastrous things that are predicted to come upon the earth, one right after the other. And so the people on the earth are going to be subjected to the most horrifying time in all of earth history. It's going to be far worse than the flood in this respect, that in the flood, there was a short period of stark terror for all of those who didn't get to get in the boat. But as the waters poured down from heaven for 40 days and 40 nights, it was over. I mean, they all drowned, and they didn't drown on the 39th day. They all drowned. The waters were higher than the tops of the mountains. And so, except for that short, brief period of extreme terror while they were trying to get away from the flood waters, trying to get to higher ground, and having the waters continually creeping up rapidly to overwhelm them, that's all they really were physically and emotionally subjected to, is a few days of fairly significant terror. We're going to die. The 70th week of Daniel is 2520. Is that 1260 twice? 2520. It's going to be 7 years, 360-day years, where everything starts just one thing after another, after another, after another, after another, after another, after another, after another. At some point, it says that men will wish they could die, and they won't even be able to. Things economically are going to get so bad that it'll cost you everything you can make just to buy enough food for one day in a day's time. A whole day's wage will be spent for one meal. It's just going to be a horrifying thing, and, you know, just enormously bad, 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 bad things. Well, the whole idea there is that it's an extended period, 2,520 days of wrath, and the details are just unveiled over and over and over from chapter 4 through 19 of the book. And under that umbrella of retribution, there are a couple things that we really need to recognize. The details of God's wrath are only being expressed in this time of wrath toward those who are still alive on the earth when it starts. In other words, all of the 2,000 years of human history from the beginning of the gospel until now, all of those generations of people who lived and died, who didn't want to know God and rejected the promise of the gospel, they're all exempt, in a sense, from experiencing this time. The only people who are going to experience the time of the 70th week or the wrath, the coming wrath, are the people who are on the planet when it starts. And, of course, there'll be all kinds of, I mean, there'll be a massive amount of dying going on. Three-quarters of the world's population will die in that seven-year period of time. But it's going to be beyond imagination horrible. But it's not going to be done to the people who were giving the Thessalonians a bad time. We need to understand that. What Paul is talking about in verse 10, when he says, when he comes on in that day, he's talking about a future event that they perhaps anticipated because they didn't know when it would start and they didn't know if they would be alive when this whole scenario began or not. But we, looking back, know that they lived and died, and the next generation lived and died, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one, however many generations there are in 2,000 years, lived and died. And they didn't experience any of the stuff that Paul is talking about in terms of the coming wrath. So we need to keep that in mind. This is a cataclysmic period of preparation for the establishment of the kingdom of God on the earth. Jesus is coming back to purge the earth of both the impact of sin on the planet itself. It's going to purge the actual physical earth, so that the poisons and all of the stuff that are in the soil and all that will be eliminated. But he's also going to purge it of all the unbelievers so that there's not a single unbeliever left to go into the kingdom. Because he told Nicodemus that. If you're not born again, you don't see or enter. It's over. So that means a couple of things. Number one, it means that the actual individual persecutors of the Thessalonians are not personally in view in this text. He is telling them that these people who are persecuting them are going to ultimately have this affliction dished out to them. But it's technically he's just using them as a type of the kind of individual that's going to get it whenever the time comes. But that doesn't mean that the final end of those individual persecutors of the Thessalonians will be significantly different from the final end of those who are on the alive on the earth when the events are played out in history. When a person dies outside of Christ before the day of wrath comes, they are instantly in what the Bible calls Hades or hell. Their experience there is not in any sense pleasant, but it is not final either, because there is Revelation 19. They are summoned out of Hades to stand before the judgment of the great white throne. And when that's all done, they go into the lake of fire, which is the final disposition of them. So in terms of difference, I don't know how much difference there is, but there is some, because Hades for now is kind of a holding place, and the lake of fire is a final place. So everybody who didn't want to know God and didn't obey the gospel is going to end up in the lake of fire. So the final end's the same in that regard. But in terms of the day of the Lord and the fact that when he comes to be glorified and so on and marveled at, that's going to be a single generation reality, the people who are alive in that day. So what we have here is that the phrase, the day of the Lord, does have this long expanded period of time in view, many days, making up a day. So really what we're talking about is the presentation of the coming of Jesus from heaven within the concept of the day of the Lord does have a final, actual, specific, one 24-hour period day, when the last of the retribution is fully and finally accomplished. The way the New Testament presents it is that after these 7 years of horrible stuff, at the end, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heavens, and Jesus will descend with all of these hosts of heaven on white horses. It's going to look like a massive cloud of white descending, and it says the whole earth will see him. So the implication is that the descent will be visible, but it will be slow enough that the earth can rotate at least once so that every eye can behold what they're seeing. Jesus is actually coming. And Zechariah 14 says that when he comes, his feet will come down on the Mount of Olives. And when his feet touch, the mountain will split in half from east to west. And there'll be a river that flows. It's going to basically eliminate the Dead Sea. It's going to open up the Dead Sea so that it can flow into what we now know as the Mediterranean. But there's going to be this river because the mountain's going to split wide open when his feet touch. So there is going to be this final 24-hour period when Jesus descends, the final day of the day of the Lord. It's a 24-hour day. So when he talks about in the day when he comes, technically, that would be the final day. And he's actually coming from heaven in that 24-hour period. But he's already, according to the way we understand the rapture issues, which we'll get into in chapter 2, he already came 7 years earlier for the church, and there's a lingering implication that he didn't go back to heaven in the sense that he is now executing the wrath of the 70th week upon all of the inhabitants of the earth. So he's either doing that personally from some visible or some presence, or he's doing it through his angelic ministers. But nonetheless, the picture is a little bit complicated. The theme, however, is the same. We have a promise in the gospel. We either believe it or we don't. If we don't, we subject ourselves to, eventually, this indescribable outpouring of the wrath of God. So that's the way the presentation's given. The day is finally, in a sense, the final elimination of everybody who's not a believer, because Jesus said you won't see or enter the kingdom if you haven't been born again. So that final descent will eliminate all of the wicked. Now, in that sense, then, the day is not about hours. It's not about whether 24 hours in it or, you know. It's really about the original definition of the day. In Genesis, the day was identified as there was an evening and a morning. The first day. That was an evening and a morning. The second day. And, of course, we understand the 24-hour issues because Earth's rotation made the evening last approximately 12 hours, and then the day lasted approximately 12 hours, and then you had another evening and another day. I mean, another light period, and the evening and the morning constituted a day. In terms of the actual dark light thing, it almost immediately became a metaphor. Because darkness became a metaphor for horrible bad things, and light became a metaphor for blessing and really, really good things. So the day of the Lord was then presented as a period that began with some really, 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 really negative wrath kind of themes, but then Messiah's kingdom would be set up and you'd have 1,000 years of blessing that's just indescribably good. So the day of the Lord starts with a short night, 7 years, and then it has this 1,000-year day period. But it's all in the Old Testament particularly, it's all the day of the Lord, both negative cursing and blessing. So that's the way the word is used, day. It just means an evening and a morning, a dark period and a light period. But it almost immediately moves into metaphor. So it's not a number of hours of darkness, of literal darkness, where the sun's not shining, and a period of daylight where the sun is shining. It's about the impact in the way the scriptures define the metaphor. Darkness signals disastrous, horrible things, and light signals really good, blessing things. So, the day of the Lord is a combination of both an extended period of many, many days. It's also, in terms of Jesus coming, a particular 24-hour day. So, what's going to happen when he comes? It's interesting that actually the phrase "in that day" is at the end of the verse in Greek. He comes in that day. All of the other stuff is before the phrase. All of the other stuff is stuck between when he should come and our testimony to you was believed. There would be another hyphen there, and then "in that day" would be at the end of the verse. But I started with the day thing simply because I want us to be aware that he's talking about some real ancient themes, the day of the Lord in terms of wrath, as well as blessing. In this case, the wrath has been the focus of the paragraph, but notice what he winds up with in verse 10. It has to do with him being glorified and with him being marveled at. The question is, what does he mean when he comes to be glorified in his saints? When he comes to be marveled at among all those who have believed? I thought those who believed were saints. I thought saints are defined in terms of believing. So the real issue here is, what is Paul talking about? What's he actually saying is going to happen in the final coming, when Jesus comes back and the wrath is poured out and is finally culminated, when Jesus actually descends from heaven with all of these so-called saints? They're called holy ones. That's the word, hagioi. It's the word that's typically translated saints, but sometimes it doesn't mean human saints. It means holy ones, referring to the angels. So, there are two categories in verse 10 of people that are affected by his coming in that day. One of them is the holy ones, his holy ones, and the other is all who have believed. And that's reinforced by the fact that the Thessalonians were among those whose testimony was believed, who believed the testimony. Our testimony to you was believed. So the Thessalonians identified as among these believers. The question is, does he really mean two different statements of the same category of individual, saints as the people of God and believers as the people of God, just defined in terms of maybe a characteristic identity, saints, as opposed to a methodological characteristic of those who believe? Or does he actually have two categories of beings involved? That's the real question. there's either two groups or there's one group identified from two different angles. If there's one group identified from two different angles, then the issues are character and method. It's the saints because they have believed in the promise of the gospel. They've been justified by the faith, and therefore they're saints. However, there are some pretty strong indicators that that's not really what he had in mind. In Matthew 25:31, Jesus is presented as descending, as the Son of Man descending from heaven with all of his holy angels. And in Luke 9:26, that same idea of the holy angels descending with Jesus, it says, in his glory, in the glory of the Father, and in the glory of the holy angels. So there is a glory theme that's tied to this issue of the holy ones who are descending with him. But they're identified as holy angels. And in 1 Thessalonians 3:13, so that he may establish your hearts unblameable in holiness before our God and Father at the coming of our Lord Jesus with all his saints. Or is it with all his holy ones? Well, it's with all his holy ones. But they translate saints, and the implication, prejudicial implication, is it's people. But what if it's, he's going to establish your hearts unblameable in holiness before our God and Father at the coming of our Lord Jesus with all his holy ones? What if it's angels? Because Paul does typically use the word translated saints, holy ones, to refer to human beings. But not always. Typically, yes. But that 1 Thessalonians 3:13 actually may have the angels in mind, and Matthew 25 and Luke 9 and other places identify Jesus as coming from heaven with the holy angels. So he's descending from heaven with all his holy ones. Now, the pre-tribulational rapturists believe that the church will be descending with him, so all of his holy ones would include them too, angels and the church descending with him. But it's interesting what's going to happen in relation to the issues of glory and marveling. Both of those are passive verbs, participles, to be glorified either in, with, by, or among his holy ones. In, on, whatever, that day, that's the same preposition, and to be marveled at, and then they translate among all those who have believed. What's he saying? Well, I believe this is what he's saying. When Jesus comes on that day, he is going to be glorified by a certain group of creatures called holy ones. And the issue of glorification is the issue of somebody's characteristics being made clear, known, made known. We talk about glorifying somebody, and typically we're talking about praising their positive characteristics. We glorify this person or that person because of certain characteristics they have or certain abilities that they have. And that's what glory is all about. And getting glory means that you have people who are willing to attribute these attributes to you. You get their glory when they attribute these attributes to you. So the whole idea of being glorified implies this, that all of the words in the world concerning the outpouring of the wrath of God are really not apt to communicate the reality. When the reality happens, his glory will be made very clear, and a part of that is going to be when the angels do what they do when they come with him. Because according to, I don't remember if it's Matthew 25 or Luke 9, but one of those two says that when he comes, he's going to send his holy angels to the opposite ends of heaven to get all of the elect. It's neither one of those passages, it's another one. But anyway, he's going to send the angels, the holy angels, to gather together all of his elect from one end of heaven to the other. That's kind of interesting. It implies that they're scattered all over. And for the coming of Jesus from heaven, he's going to send the angels to go get them all. So this is going to be a massive display of holy ones coming with Jesus. Maybe humans and angelic. But this is going to be a demonstration of glory in a sense, in a way, that's never been seen by human eyes in this world, ever. He's going to be glorified by the appearance of these holy ones with him. And then, secondly, he's going to be marveled at by believers. Now, the marveling, I don't think it's going to be as much by the people who've already been in heaven, been in the third heaven with paradise. They've seen a lot of things since they've been there. And I'm sure that there's a lot more to be seen. And in that sense, they may marvel at what they see. But I really think that he's going to be marveled at by those who have believed without seeing. So the point here is that there are going to be two things that happen when Jesus comes. His glory is going to be manifest in a way that has never been manifested, and that's going to involve the holy ones. And then he's going to be shocking the minds of those who have believed, because the word marvel means to be stunned almost out of your ability to think. You're just stunned. You're standing there with your mouth open. And the straightforward implication of both of those terms is exactly what Paul said when he said, "The glory that is to be revealed is not worthy to be compared to the things that are going on in this present world, because they are incomparable." And the only way they can be incomparable is if they're so much beyond anything that we've experienced here that when we see them, we will be stunned into almost a mind-numbing reality. That's what it means to marvel. So the big picture of the paragraph is the outpouring of the retribution. The smaller issue is the impact it makes on those who believe the gospel, that got to know God, verse 8, and believe, submitted to the gospel. Those people are in for, I suppose you could call it, a very remarkable treat. It's going to be negative in a sense, because it's going to be a display of his wrath and power. But in that display, they're going to see things about Jesus that they never even dreamed. And it's going to be such an eye-opening revelation. That's what he calls it. Revelation. The revelation of the Son from heaven. That's what it was called in verse 7, when Jesus is revealed from heaven. It's a revelation. It's a whole different picture of this one who died for us so that we could be a part of the glory of an eternal kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy. So verse 10 is an upbeat final statement. It's about the impact that this new dawning realization of who Jesus is and what he's really like settling upon us who have believed, and upon and through the means of those who are his holy ones who are executing his will and way upon the earth and in the heavens. And Paul just emphasizes that by saying, you're part of this. You Thessalonians are part of this, because it's going to shock your minds because you're believers, because when we preach the gospel to you, you believed it. So now you're going to be a participant in this. And there's something to be said about the fact that even the what we would consider to be the characteristics of God that are unpleasant for us to think about, the wrath, the justice, the characteristics that would typically put ungodly sinners in a terrific bind, those characteristics, when they're seen in their reality, in their completion with all of the other characteristics about God, it's just going to be a glorious, mind-blowing event. And that's what Paul's talking about in verse 10. There are going to be those who are not going to be benefited at all by all of this revelation of Jesus from heaven. But the Thessalonians, from chapter 1 on, have been looking for the Son to come from heaven so they could be a part of this. So in that way, Paul winds the paragraph up with a very upbeat thing, because Jesus is coming to be glorified by his holy ones and to be marveled at by those who have believed him.